You hear? No.
Get a bit closer.
Closer. Like that?
Yeah.
Sure? Gabriella's the expert.
Just tilt the microphone up. Yeah, that's correct.
That's better. That's it. Okay. Glasses. I went to a reading. I've only recently started having to wear them, and you realise you're reluctant to put them on, and I went up to Yorkshire to do a reading. Got taken to the B&B, left my stuff, took the book along, and I realised I'd left my glasses in the back at the B&B, and thought, well, that's fine, I'm sure I can still... And I couldn't see a thing. I opened the book, and it was a blur. But if anybody's ever in this position, well, that audience, I just said, anyone got ready readers 1.5, and someone did have, so I was able to read from them. That's only to explain this, but on the slip it says I'm reading a story called Every Third Thought, but that's a cancer farce, and I've thought again, really, because, it's July. I tried to write a cancer story and see if I could make the subject not funny, well, to get some laughs anyway, on the basis that if you speed up tragedy, you get farce. If you think of cartoons and so on. That's basically what tragedy is. It's a slowed down farce, or the other way around, you see. But instead, from that collection, my last collection was called Constitutional, and they published it in America as well, but they wouldn't call it Constitutional for obvious reasons, I suppose. It doesn't mean a walk to do you good there. Instead, they wanted various changes, and I wouldn't do any, but then they said, oh, well, we'll have an extra story then, which I wrote. And I did a couple. One's called In the Driver's Seat, which is what they then called the collection, because they said, it sounds like a woman in control. And the other one is called Up at a Villa, which is the one I'm going to read, and it's just because it's a holiday story. There's more sunshine. Right. Up at a villa. They were woken by the deep-chested bawling of an angry baby. Wrenched from wine-dark slumber, the four of them sat up, flustered, hair stuck with pine needles, gulping awake with little light breaths of concentration. They weren't supposed to be here, they remembered that. They could see the baby by the side of the pool, not 20 yards away, a furious geranium in its parasol-shaded buggy, and the large, pale woman sagging above it in her bikini. Half an hour ago, they had been masters of that pool, racing topless and tipsy round its borders, lithe Nick chasing sinewy Tina and wrestling her, an equal match, grunting, snaky, toppling, crashing down into the turquoise depths together. Neither of them would let go underwater. They came up fighting in a chlorinated spume of diamonds. Joe, envious, had tried a timid imitation grapple, but Charlotte was having none of it. "Get off," she snorted, kind, mocking, and slipped neatly into the pool via a dive that barely broke the water's skin. Joe, seeing he was last as usual, gave a foolish bellow and launched his heavy self into the air, his aimless belly slapping down disastrously like an explosion. After that, the sun had dried them off in about a minute. They had devoured their picnic of pissaladiere and peaches, downed the bottles of pink wine, and gone to doze in the shade behind the ornamental changing screen. Now they were stuck. Their clothes and money were heaped under a bush of lavender at the other end of the pool. "Look," whispered Tina, as a man came walking toward the baby and its mother. "Look, they're English. He's wearing socks." "What's the matter with her now?" said the man, glaring at the baby. "Well, how should I know?" said the woman. "I mean, she's been fed. She's got a new nappy." "Oh, plug her on again," said the man crossly, and wandered off towards a cushioned chaise longue. "That noise goes straight through my skull." The woman muttered something they couldn't hear and shrugged herself out of her bikini top. They gasped and gaped in fascination as she uncovered huge brown nipples on breasts like wheels of camembert. "Oh, gross," whispered Tina, drawing her lips back from her teeth in a horrified smirk. "Be quiet," hissed Nick, as they all of them heaved with giggles and snorts, and their light eyes popped, over-emphatic in faces baked to the colour of flower pots. They had crept into the grounds of this holiday villa, one of a dozen or more on this hillside, at Slippery Nick's suggestion, since everything was Fermé le Lundi down in the town, and they had no money left for entrance to hotel pools or even to beaches. Anyway, they had fallen out of love over the last week with the warm soup of the Mediterranean, its filmy surface bobbing with polystyrene shards and other unsavoury aughts. "Harvey," called the woman, sagging on the stone bench with a baby at her breast. "Harvey, I wish you'd..." "Now what is it?" said Harvey, testily, making a great noise with his two-day-old copy of the Times. "Some company," she said, with wounded pathos, "that's all." "Company," he sighed. "I thought the idea was to get away from it all." "I thought we'd have a chance to talk on holiday," said the woman. All right," said Harvey, scrumpling up the Times and exchanging his chaise longue for a place on the stone bench beside her. "All right, so what do you want to talk about?" "Us," said the woman. "Right," said Harvey, "can I have a swim first?" And he was off, diving clumsily into the pool, losing his poise at the last moment so that he met the water like a flung cat. "She's hideous," whispered Tina. "Look at that gross stomach, it's all in folds." She glanced down superstitiously at her own body, the high breasts like halved apples, the handspan waist. "He's quite fat too," said Charlotte. "Love handles anyway." "I'm never going to have children," breathed Tina, "not in a million years." "Shh," said Joe, straining forward for the next instalment. The husband was back from his swim, shaking himself like a Labrador in front of the nursing mother. "Us," he said humorously, wiggling a finger inside each ear, then rubbing his hair with the flats of his hands. "Fire away, then." She started immediately, as if she knew she had only 2 or 3 minutes of his attention, and soon the air was thick with phrases like, "Once she's on solids," and "You'd rather be reading the paper," and "Is it because you wanted a boy?" He looked dull but resigned, silent except for once protesting, "What's so special about bath time?" She talked on, but like a loser, for she was failing to find the appropriate register, flailing around, pulling clichés from the branches. At some subliminal level, each of the eavesdropping quartet recognised their own mother's voice in hers and glazed over. "You've never moaned on like this before," marvelled Harvey at last. "You were always so independent, organised." "You think I'm a mess," she said, "a failure as a mother." "Well, you're obviously not coping," he said. "At home all day and you can't even keep the waste bins down." Nick and Tina were laughing with silent violence behind the screen, staggering against each other, tears running down their faces. Joe was mesmerised by the spectacle of lactation. As for Charlotte, she was remembering another unwitting act of voyeurism, a framed picture from a childhood camping holiday. It had been early morning. She'd gone off on her own to the village for their breakfast baguettes, and the village had been on a hill like in a fairy tale, full of steep little flights of steps, which she was climbing for fun. The light was sweet and glittering, and as she looked down over the rooftops, she saw very clearly one particular open window, so near that she could have lobbed in a 10-franc piece. And through the window she could see a woman dropping kisses onto a man's face and neck and chest. He was lying naked in bed, and she was kissing him lovingly and gracefully, her breasts dipping down over him like silvery peonies. Charlotte had never mentioned this to anyone, keeping the picture to herself, a secret snapshot protected from outside sniggerings. "The loss of romance," bleated the woman, starting afresh. "We haven't changed," said Harvey stoutly. "Yes, we have, of course we have." "Rubbish." "But we're supposed to change. It's all different now. The baby's got to come first." "I don't see why," said Harvey. "Mustn't let them rule your life." The baby had finished at last and was asleep. The woman gingerly detached her from her body and placed her in the buggy. "Cheer up," said Harvey, preparing for another dip. "Once you've lost a bit of weight, it'll all be back to normal. Romance, etc. Get yourself in shape." "You don't fancy me anymore," she wailed in a last-ditch attempt to hold him. "No, no, of course I do," he said, eyeing the water. "It's just a bit different from before. Now that you've gone all, you know, sort of floppy." That did it. At the same moment as the woman unloosed a howl of grief, Nick and Tina released a semi-hysterical screech of laughter. Then, "Run," said Joe, and they all shot off round the opposite side of the pool, snatching up their clothes and shoes and purses at the other end. Harvey was meanwhile shouting, "Hoy! Hoy! What the hell do you think you're playing at?" while his wife stopped crying and his daughter started. The four of them ran like wild deer, leaping low bushes of lavender and thyme, whooping with panicky delight, lean and light and half naked, or more accurately, nine-tenths naked, through the pine trees and après-midi dappling. They ran on winged feet, and their laughter looped the air behind them like chains of bubbles in translucent water. High up on the swimming pool terrace, the little family, frozen together for a photographic instant, watched their flight open-mouthed, like the ghosts of summers past, or indeed, of summers yet to come. Thank you very much. And listening to that lovely extract from the novel, The Dog, and listening to a story, I think the only real difference you notice at a reading is that the story, because you can read it complete, you've got the shape. And that's what's worried me about writing a novel. I've just wondered, how would you keep the shape in your head all the way through? You know, do you know what shape... Yeah, well... But do you have a shape in, do you have a shape in mind?
Yeah, I've got the arc worked out. I'm sort of halfway through now, so...
So you have an idea of an arc?
Yeah.
Yes. Because with stories, I lay them out quite often if I know the length, and put the pieces of paper out, and then sort of see whether it's going to accelerate at the end or dip down. But sometimes, I've tried to do a circular story once. That was the constitutional one. And that was really hard. But that's quite useful for a story, anyway.
Have you not written another day?
No.
How did you get to be granted Best of Young British Novelists?
Well, I don't know. Maybe they thought I was going to, you know. I've written a novella, sort of vegetarian stomach churner. Flesh and grass.
Is it something you just really enjoy? Is writing short stories? And if you think about a novel, you just think, actually, you know, the process of writing and being a writer is something you have to enjoy. So why do something you don't enjoy just because there's a kind of demand to?
Yes. Well, I like reading novels as much as I like reading short stories, but I just find a lot of them. Go on too long. A lot of padding, you know. I start, get on with it, come on. And I think I just tend to sort of condense things down. I was reading some Grace Paley stories the other day, and you actually only want one at a time, really, with Grace Paley. She only wrote enough to fill a sort of fat paperback, and she had a long life. But she wrote these, I think, four collections of stories. But almost you don't want more. They're like Marmite. They're very sort of pungent and laconic, and just in two or three pages, you know they're different sort of reading from a novel. When I'm reading a novel, I like to go down and get lost in it. And people describe sinking into a bath more with a novel, but you're not sinking into a bath with a story.
Have you, when you say writing a novella, did you ever think you wanted to extend it or go further? Or
I did. I liked doing it, actually. I really did like that one because the main luxury was having the same subject and the same characters, and not having to start a new hair. The thing about stories, you never get bored writing them because, well, I don't, because you're tackling some different subject each time. But it does take a lot, you know, it's very wasteful of time. It takes a lot of, I take time revving up to doing the next one. I do my reading and thinking about it. But with the novella, of course, that I did that in under 6 months. It was much more time effective. So maybe I'll do a novel one day. Yeah.
How long do you take on average to write your short story?
Oh, I wish I... the actual writing's quite fast, but it's the sort of... It's working out what the idea is and what it's about and doing some reading and thinking about it. That I'm a slow thinker, I think. I tend to carry around... I don't know whether everyone here is a student of creative writing, are they? Mostly? Well, many people, because the thing I wish someone had told me earlier on, but I used to write on the backs of envelopes or in maps or edges of newspapers, but actually buy a little batch of those 4x5 cards, like postcard sized, or just plain postcards. And I only have about 3 thoughts a day, so that one a day is not too extravagant, and then you can sort of transfer them at the end of the day to what you're working on, maybe.
What's your main triggers for stories? Are you triggered by places or by people or conversations you have in here? Is there something that particularly lights your fire?
Well, I wish I could say yes. I think it would be much easier to sell a collection if you knew you were going to write all sort of stories on the same subject. Because I take so long, I just have to trust to the fact that at any stage in your life you tend to be obsessed with something or other. You know, you're going through a particular interest, and after 3 or 4 years you're out of that and you're into the next one. But I'm just hoping that gives, well, it does to the collections I've done, some sort of unity in that way. But I noticed they found it much easier to sell. There was one collection called Hey Yeah Right Get a Life, which sold more easily because it was mainly about mothers and young children, and that was because I was reflecting on a time when I'd had young children, and it was a new subject as well, it felt like, and but it was a much more restricted canvas that I'd been used to. That worked all right, but well, constitutional, yes, it's a lovely word, that, because it means going for a walk but does you good. It's what your grandmother would say. It's like it wasn't a class thing. Everybody said, I'm going for my constitutional. And then when they washed their hands, they say, I'm making my ablutions. They had these couple of Latinate words. But constitutional, well, it's a gift. If you want to talk about the body and the way it wears out or the way it works, so you can pull in a lot of that. I've been reading a lot of books on Alzheimer's, and I wanted to do something on memory and what happens, how it works and what happens when it retreats. And that was the story written like a circle, and it was really hard. That took ages. That took 3 months at least of sort of going at it and going at it. But I wanted it was like a wreath, I wanted to weave in stuff. It's a circular walk that I think it takes an hour to read. It's an hour long walk, so it's in real time. But it's doing that thing when you go on a walk, you dip in and out of your memory, and it just tries to weave in scraps on the theme, as well as tell the story. You've got to have some sort of plot as well. And I was thinking if I could say anything useful about the story tonight, and I really never know what rules to come up with, because I really don't know myself, except the only rule I've ever come up with for myself was something's got to happen in a story, but not too much. It's sometimes you get mood poems where nothing much happens at all, nothing does happen. Lots of really good writers, Colette and Virginia Woolf, they've done mood, but they're not real stories. Something's got to happen. But it can be as slight as, you know, it's got to be a little movement or a change.
Why do you say not too much?
Well, once you start having lots of plot and lots of action, it becomes a mini novel. You might as well, I mean, why not write novels? They strike me as, they're like a higher gossip. They're full of details, they're very particularised. You want to know what and where and how and what people are wearing. And a story you can sort of, if you're going to enjoy writing it, it seems to me that you don't need much of that. You can, it's more like a song. You don't even need names if you're careful. I was reading, I saw someone have photocopied a piece from the Sunday paper. There was a Susan Hill wrote a little piece this Sunday on this short story. Very nice piece, but she was saying the only thing about it is it's small. I wasn't sure. I'm not sure that I would say that it was necessarily a short story is always small. Because you wouldn't call a song small or a poem. But, right, hello?
The thing that really hit me about the story that you read is your characters were so vivid. The story was almost relevant. It was just the meeting of those characters. And it could have been any part of their lives in a way. It was just great to meet them.
Oh, well, good. But it's again with a story, I think people are attracted to them. They like a particular situation. I mean, when you've got a... If you read Maupassant, really very little happens in his story except there's a situation, someone's stuck. Sometimes they don't resolve them. They're in this situation, and that's the point. You know, it's sort of un-get-outable.
From that aspect, it was almost like you sort of, in a short story, you can leave it there, or you could embellish it out and tell us about the rest of their lives.
Well, that you would do if you were writing a novel, I guess, yes. Maybe I will one day.
When you write a short story, do you always have the characters really formed in your mind, or is it more of an exploration when you start out?
No, I usually, with a story, I'm pretty much done by the time I sit down to write it. It's sort of, that's why it's quite nice fast writing once it actually happens. But again, that's another reason to do a novel. I think it would be really well. The novella I did, that was it was fun being able to just see where things led and throw more out. With a story, I don't tend to chuck much out. I do draft, but you know, if I hadn't thought it through properly, then well, there's no point. Could be any of those, I think, without being, I'm not trying to slide out of the question, but it could, sometimes a theme, I'm trying to think, I did one, the one called If I'm Spared in Constitutional, I remember that was the theme one that I remember, I wanted to write on the theme of reprieve, someone getting off the hook, and I also wanted it, lots of smoking in it. And it was a lung cancer story. Someone gets the diagnosis, but he gets off the hook in the end. And in the end, he turned into quite a strong character. But that was definitely theme led. I don't think I usually do that or think so consciously about what it's about. But I was interested. Someone made a short film of that story, I think Edinburgh Festival or something. But when I watched it, thought, well, that completely, it seemed to miss. It was a nice film, but it was much more about the man's character. It was a man's, you know, and I hadn't been as interested in that. So, hello?
You talked in a really abstract way about, you know, what might be interesting about writing a novel as opposed to stories. Have you ever kind of thought, well, I might make shitloads of money if I wrote a novel? Would that not be a cool?
Well, yes. It's not. Well, no. It's. Of course, it'd be very nice. Yes. No, I did at one point sign a 2-book contract, I think that put me off for a while because I'd had the first collection out and it had done well, and they signed me up and I said I want to do more. So they let me do a second collection and also said, and a novel. But at that point, it's just the way life is happening to you at the time. You can't plan everything. And I had, at that point, I think I had a one-year-old and then I had another one. You know, I sort of had two very young children. I'd been asked to do something at the National Theatre as well. I was being a writer in residence. And I thought, oh my God, I've got to write a novel. And somehow you lose your sleep with little children. You lose the sort of dreaming time. And it just was completely the wrong time to sort of think, now write a novel. And I wrote it in my diary, write novel, you know, I sort of mapped it out. And it just wasn't so, and I got so worried about that and anxious that it sort of put me off for a long while, I think. But now, no, I think I've got a nice idea. I've had it for a while, a few years, but... but there are a lot of... I don't understand why people love novels quite as... I mean, there are a lot of novels... I mean, we're a very fattest society. Everyone's always commenting on each other's weight. But you get lots of really fat novels that have run out of puff and sort of moan and complain a lot and move too slowly. And the stories, when they're good, they're just lean, mean machines. You know, they do the business. Huh. Well, yes.
You know, I'll often read, particularly in this collection, and I want to know more about the characters, and I want the next chapter, but I quite like having that sensation of just... You know,
well, I'll tell you what, the thing that might lead me on to writing, I mean, the thing you can't do in a story, but you can do in a novel, is show time passing and do it properly and show characters changing in time. I mean, you can foreshorten things in a story, you can jump from... The person who does that is Alice Munro. She just is amazing. She can take decades, you know, she can take a whole life. But I really don't think her stories are stories. I call them novels with the boring bits left out. She really, I mean, they're very unusual, but... Hmm. Are most people doing novels here? Or stories?
We have this meeting with a publisher, and they actually really try to put you off writing full stories.
Well, yes. Well, as you say, they don't sell as well as novels. They really don't. But I have made a living, so you know, I've been publishing now for. The first lot came out in 1990. And I've kept. You see, the thing is with the stories, if you do get to a point where you're selling them. They make the first lot of money with first British serial rights, or then maybe you're lucky and it gets to an American magazine and they pay well. And the newspapers have started taking occasional stories, so they can make, you know, that in that case you're very lucky because that's several thousand sometimes. Radio, I saw radio boasting about itself as a main commissioner, but you'd have to write. I mean, that really is much less. That's a couple of hundred if you're lucky, you know. So, but you can make a living because then there's a spin-offs. One of mine turned into a, I don't know, jazz musicians decided to turn it into a jazz opera and that was televised. So weird things can happen, or people can decide to make a little film or a play. But then you can get the collection going. The collection goes all right and then it might sell in some other countries. It might go to America if you're lucky, you know. So it's sort of luck. But you can keep a modest living going. I think I've made enough over the years to just keep myself. I haven't made enough to be a family woman, but you know, I've sort of. Yep, is that enough then? Thank you. Right. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you.